What happens when man is left to himself? Is man essentially good, loving and caring for others? Or will man revert to his primal self, or is there something entirely different at work? The Lord of the Flies gives the picture of man when all authority is removed. One of the ways in which God governs the world is through authority, beginning with parents, including teachers and rulers, and even employers, as the means by which he governs the world. When this authority is removed, what is left? William Golding explores this theme as he tells the story of a few boys who are left to live among each other without any authority whatsoever. The story, haunting though it might be, is the story of how the Lord of the Flies can inspire even the most seemingly pure among us to evil deeds. Welcome to Lies Speaking Truth, a podcast about the intersection of faith and popular fiction. I'm Roy Askins, and here's my co-host, Chris Gillespie.
Glad to be with you.
Francis Rossow, in his book Gospel Patterns in Literature, points out that sometimes the gospel can spill out of a story in unexpected ways, perhaps even ways not originally intended by the author. The purpose of Lies Speaking Truth is to look at young adult literature to see in what way the gospel does, or doesn't, spill out. A novel or fiction story does not speak the truth about the events it records, but it may, and more often than not does, speak a certain truth about the world. That is, a novel or a fiction story is a lie that speaks a truth. Our Lord calls us to be discerning in our interactions with the world, and here at Lies Speaking Truth, we seek to provide some insights into the various themes of other popular works. While we certainly do not limit ourselves to young adult fiction, we will emphasize young adult fiction as well as other recognized literary classics.
Thank you, Roy. If you would like to make requests, hear recent podcasts, sign up for our podcast in iTunes, or for our mailing list, please visit liesspeakingtruth.org. That's liesspeakingtruth, all one word, .org. Or email us at talkback@liesspeakingtruth.org.
The purpose of this podcast is to take a look at modern and classic literature through the lens of an Orthodox Christian faith. This isn't to baptize whatever fiction happens to cross our path, to baptize whatever young adult fiction we happen to read, but to learn how to think about this from the perspective of an Orthodox Christian, to actually say, what does this say about the human condition? What does this say about salvation and redemption? What does this say about Jesus Christ? Does it say anything about Jesus Christ? Should I read it if it doesn't say anything about Jesus Christ or doesn't have Christological themes in it? And how does this, how will these stories affect our lives? Like, what value these fictions have for our lives?
Correct. And uniquely then, you know, from my perspective, both as a pastor, because people, you know, you use media as part of your connection to the culture of the people. You know, they watch movies, they read books, they listen to music. That's going to be one way to connect realistically with what they're feeling or thinking. But then certainly as a father, as a parent, to be able to evaluate or learn how to evaluate even, in this case specifically, literature for the use in your home so that you can be a good parent and be able to actually dialogue with your children about what they read and what they're understanding or what they're thinking when they're reading. So listen, or what do they call that in the standardized testing? Reading comprehension.
In terms of general guidelines for the podcast, since this is the first one we're putting out, the two kind of books we are using as part of the lens through which we look at this literature is a book by Dr. Jean Edward Veith called Reading Between the Lines, A Christian Guide to Literature. In this book, Dr. Veith provides an overview of the different kinds of literature there are out in the world, and how these conform to an aesthetic standard or whether or not such work does. And the other book is The Universe Next Door, A Basic Worldview Catalog by James W. Sire. And both of these books provide excellent insight into learning how to think like someone outside of your own personal worldview and perhaps even how to analyze a piece of literature, a piece of work like this, a piece of art.
and its value. So the other thing to note in these podcasts is we're assuming you have read the work, so we will give out the ending. If you are such a person who likes to not know the ending, please pause the podcast and actually read The Lord of the Flies, which will be our first podcast today, first. If you like to know the ending before you read it, then just listen on.
Which we don't suggest.
Okay, anything else before we get into a general overview of the plot, Chris?
Yeah, actually, I think it might be helpful. Do you know anything about the author, William Golding?
I can actually. I logged into Britannica. Actually, before we do that, one thing important thing to note here is we're not doing this literature or studying literature to analyze the author through the work of art. We will talk about the author and give just a general overview of who he is and what his life is. But the primary purpose of this studying the story is not to psychoanalyze the author, but rather to take the story as it is, as a story. But getting on to Sir William Golding, he was born in 1911 and died in 1993. Wow. He won the Nobel Prize for his literature, I think probably for The Lord of the Flies, which was his first published novel. He has a couple other novels that aren't as well known, but The Lord of the Flies was his first published novel. He was in the Royal Navy and took part in some action, German action, or fighting the Germans in World War II. And then began publishing novels, or writing novels, after the war was over.
Excellent, thank you. Yeah, the reason I ask is, you know, some of the context of the book, particularly the book with the Navy officers, or the father being a Navy man, right? And right. What was the other things that that came to mind there?
The Navy is ultimately the one that saves the...
Right.
The boys.
Which is right. The hope throughout that the Navy will save. Right.
At least the hope of Ralph. Right.
Correct.
Right. I mean, eventually the boys that became the wild savage tribe had no desire or thought of being saved. It was Ralph that continually drove for that desire to be saved.
But the point being is that that's really only interesting or relevant to the discussion after you've read the book.
right.
Right, because it being the Navy is really secondary plot information, so.
Right.
Yeah, very good.
Okay, so a basic overview of the plot. It's a story about a group of boys during a post, what seems to be, it's never explicitly stated, but what seems to be a World War II, post-World War II context. Or during World War II context. And their airplane has crashed, and these boys find themselves on a deserted island. The beginning of the book starts with Ralph and Piggy, and the two main characters. They meet, and they find this conch, the shell that eventually becomes a symbol of democracy and order. And Piggy convinces Ralph to blow the conch in order to call any other missing boys together. And they form a small society, you might say, and they elect Ralph to be the leader of this society. One of the first actions that Ralph takes is to elect another group of boys, led by Jack, to be the hunters of the community, to go and search for meat and to find meat, as well as to keep what becomes the one of the most important symbols for who Ralph is. Part of the group of the task of this hunting community is to keep the fire going so that any ships passing by during the day might see the smoke. So those are the two major tasks of the hunting group. The conch shell becomes, as we talked about, the symbol of democracy and order. Therefore, whoever, you know, the conch is blown in order to call an assembly where all the boys come together. If you want to speak in the assembly, you have to be holding the conch, the shell, in order to be able to speak. And everybody is supposed to be quiet during this time. After these initial points in the book, the book goes on to record the struggles of the boys as they learn to cope with authority among each other. And it largely becomes the struggle between the authority of Ralph and Jack. Ralph was elected by vote, but Jack eventually, by virtue of his ability to hunt and to provide food and at least seemingly to provide protection from this beast that they think is out there somewhere, he begins to seize authority that he thinks should be his. The struggle can kind of be seen as Ralph tries to enforce keeping the fire lit, whereas Jack is more focused on and actually neglects his duty to keep the fire lit and focuses more on hunting and providing meat. The story continues and records how the boys degenerate into a sort of a barbarism, eventually killing a young boy named Simon, who was, you might say, had become the messenger of the Lord of the Flies. We'll talk about that actually when we get there eventually. The boys mistake Simon for the beast that they've been hunting and they're afraid of, and they kill him and send him out to sea. Eventually, all the boys leave Ralph, I should say, and join Jack and his tribe in their own community that they've formed, that he rules by dictatorship rather than popular election, popular vote. And they all join him. Eventually, Piggy is killed, and Ralph has to run and try to escape Jack and his cohort that spend the rest of their time on the island trying to kill Ralph, because Jack rightly understands and sees Ralph as a threat to his authority as long as he's alive. Ralph is almost, you might say, saved by the bell as the British Navy shows up when they see the fire from the island and saves the boys. So that's just the general overview of the plot. Did I miss anything else, Chris, that needs to be mentioned?
No, I think that's a pretty good summary. You actually suggested that the first major theme is related to civilization and barbarism, or democracy and dictatorship. You probably got that from the intro, right?
Yeah, my dad.
Okay, yeah.
The intro, incidentally, the edition of the book we're using, the intro is very, very good by E.M. Forster. I highly recommend it.
So 50th anniversary edition, and we'll provide a link on the podcast so you can go up and purchase your own copy. And it has very nice cut pages on the side that make it very easy to turn the page. And not quite.
As long as you're on the right side of the page.
Right. It gives you that classic, you know, hand-cut book feel, so which is important when you're reading.
Just enough to be annoying. Anyways, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So regarding the major themes, I can't help but read this text, considering first and foremost the character of the people and their inclination to evil, which is, I really believe, the major theme, and that's the real problem, if you like, and the symptom is how it plays out in the lives of the children is these various ruling, ordering schemes. So, in other words, is dictatorship order? Or is it actually chaos? Ordered chaos, if you like. That's an interesting question I have. Because it seems to be that it's truly a dictator rules upon the most base nature of man, which is, you know, fear, anger, hatred, murder for that matter, especially in this text, and whatnot. And that's really their means of ruling, but it's also it seems to me it's actually what the people want. They don't, otherwise they'd rise up against the dictator. And there are those for whatever reason rise up against the dictator. But dictators are hard to overthrow. Not because they just hold the seat of power, but because they've been granted a certain degree of that power, really authority by the people.
Right, by the people themselves.
Right.
By their desire to be governed by.
So Jack provides the opportunity. He invites the people, we're working from the end of the book here, but it doesn't matter, provides the opportunity for others to follow and to become part of the choir, dressed as the choir, painted as the choir, etc. And even invites his opponents to join with him or go against him. Obviously, there's consequence for not joining with him. Whereas the democracy, there is no ruling. There is no distinction between those who are with and for and against. All are for, right? What was the other theme I was thinking of with this? Oh, there is also it seems to me that Golding is working with this idea that political structures require maturity. Because these are children, and the children know through the example of their parents or of England, they know that order is necessary. At least they do at the beginning of the book, and there's a deference to the conch or the conch or whatever, the shell. There's a deference to those who hold the shell. But even right away, there's the struggle over the control of the shell.
Right. Even like almost in the first assembly meeting, there was still the struggle over, you know, you shouldn't be talking when someone's holding the conch. You know, this is sacrosanct. You should not speak. Even then, they had a struggle, even in the first meeting, the first assembly.
Right. And over time, I mean, Ralph has this kind of epiphany at some point that he's treating that shell with reverence, you know, as a seat of authority, even though he found it.
Right. Right, right.
what gives this shell its particular authority is actually the people.
Right. Right. And this story is the chronicle of how that shell lost that authority. I mean, it's really symbolized when the rock comes and kills Piggy and dashes the shell to pieces, and it just shatters into it. And I believe it even describes it. He describes it as a dust is what it shatters to. The authority, all order and direction on the island has been lost with that shell.
Right before that, Piggy, you know, places it in Ralph's hand, and the little children, seeing the familiar symbol, what does he call them? Litlins. Seeing the familiar symbol started to come back. You know, so even then, after having followed Jack, they still recognize the authority of this symbol.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so we're talking about Ralph, and Ralph. Yeah, Ralph really is the main character, right? He's the story really follows him. I don't think it ever leaves him, does it? It does for a bit. I'm up on the island once or twice. I don't think it ever completely leaves it for Jack. I think the story sticks with Ralph pretty much the entire time, and it's from his viewpoint.
It is from his viewpoint. What do you call this? His voice, narrator's voice. There's a word for this.
Third-person omniscient.
Third-person omniscient.
Yeah, but well, third person limited, you might say. I mean, because you don't really get too much of Jack's thoughts. I mean, you do see it, but you don't really get too much of Jack's thoughts. So usually he's in the right. You're in the head of Ralph for the majority of the book, I think.
Correct. Correct.
And Ralph is kind of the order, the symbol of order and elected authority, right? Really, the symbol of democracy. As we talked about, Ralph's father was in the Navy, and Ralph assured the little boys, the Litlins, as well as the Biggins, that his father would rescue them. And his primary focus throughout the entire book is not even so much food or providing food, but providing what little shelter he can, the primary focus actually being on the fire and getting the boys rescued.
Correct. Correct. And it is interesting that there is the distinction between this rescue is long-term. And Jack is concerned, we'll get to Jack here in a minute, but Jack is concerned about short term. You know, he's concerned about the moment. He's not concerned about the future. And that, well, that's going to play out here. Piggy is somewhere in between. What about Piggy?
Piggy is kind of the science. He's the rational one, the intelligent one. Ralph even realizes this. At first, Ralph kind of puts Piggy off. He laughs at him because Piggy tells him that his name is Piggy. In fact, do we ever get Piggy's real name? I don't think we do.
No, the people called him, well, that's what they called him in his school, right, Piggy?
Yeah.
And Jack's derogatory for him is Fatty. But I think those are the only two words that anybody refers to him as.
Right. But Piggy's really the smart one. He's constantly looking up to the grown-ups and the authority of the grown-ups. He's the one that convinces Ralph to hold, to blow the conch and to use that as the symbol of authority. He's the one that's always upholding the conch as the symbol of authority. In fact, even though Ralph is the one who is in charge of the community, the conch is really more closely associated with Piggy. Because of this authority that Piggy puts behind it.
Right. Piggy is constantly calling, you know, he has the conch, or right. when the children speak up or giggle or whatever.
Well, the other thing about Piggy we can't forget is the spectacles. And without the spectacles, without his glasses, he's the only one that has glasses, and his asthma, or asmar, as Ralph calls it. Piggy's spectacles are very important because without the spectacles, there is no fire. Without the fire, there is no smoke. Without the smoke, there is no rescue. And so not only is Piggy the one who is the inspiration behind the order in the community, the conch, he's also the one that brings about the possibility of being rescued by the fire through his spectacles. Jack, on the other hand, is more of disorder and chaos. He, ironically, and I find this really, really ironic, he was the leader of a choir. There was a group of boys that made it through the crash landing of the airplane on the island, and this group of boys was a choir, and Jack was the choir leader. Originally, he tried to take authority right at the beginning of the book, but the boys, by popular vote, elected Ralph instead, largely because he held the conch, the shell.
You're absolutely right. He's the pious type.
Right, right. But see, his piety and his faith, I mean, faith is never spoken of. There is no mention of God, which is really ironic, I think, because the religious perspective is usually something that is perceived to be the purview of young children, right? Of all the people in society, we would expect young boys to be crying out to God in some sense, right? They haven't reached the point in their life where they're doubting in any sense. They're all under 12 years old, right? So there is no sense of skepticism or doubt here, but God never actually comes up, despite the fact that these are choir boys, right? That these are boys who spend their life singing to God and singing hymns to God. But despite all that, Jack becomes the arch nemesis of Ralph. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that that Jack does. You know, he is a religious type, but he's religious. He's not a faithful person.
Okay.
So he's a choir board leader, but that's why it's so I believe it's so easy for him to transition into another religious practice, which is what dictatorship is. It's really a religious order of society.
You see that in the dances. The dances are the ritual that completely fit in. I mean, the group of hunters, they do these dances and they reenact the act of killing the pig, right? Every time they kill a pig, there's this dance, this ritual dance. And that comes from Jack and the choir. And so the point you make there, he's religious, just not faithful in the sense of all people are in some sense religious, whether or not. The question is, what is their religion?
Right.
What
is their faith? There is a lesson to be learned there for Christian parents, Christian church in general, is that don't presume because the children are behaving as Christians that their faith is not in jeopardy all the time,
right?
From the assaults of the world, but in the context of this book, from the assaults of their old Adam,
right.
Their sinful man, it's there and it's doing war for their not only their practice but for their faith, for where they put their trust, and they.
Right.
It's clear that Jack does not put his trust in adults, nor in God. He's actually not even interested in adults.
Right.
What they think, their authority structure, he only defers to it at the beginning because that's the popular opinion amongst the group. But he shows no interest in rescue, because rescue would mean no more fun. Which I thought was interesting, because that's their popular religion is what is fun,
yeah.
Which of course has implications for the Christian church as well. But our practice isn't principally about having fun killing the beast,
right?
But it's seeking rescue,
right?
From our perspective, seeking salvation. So
yeah. The other thing to note about Jack is Jack also has his own symbol of authority in contrast to the conch, and this is the mask that he wears. When he first tries to kill a piglet, wasn't it? It was a smaller pig, a baby pig?
Yeah, it wasn't the boar. It was earlier, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and he tries to kill the pig, and he can't. He can't bring himself to do it, and he feels the shame for it. And as long as he doesn't wear the mask, he can't do it. But when he finally puts the mask on, he paints his face with this kind of war paint. That enables him to become the killer and the savage that he is. And for the most part, for the rest of the book, he wears that mask. And the mask also becomes a symbol of authority for those around him. The Golding says that the mask compels the other young boys to follow Jack and go hunting. And as they join his savage tribe later on in the book, they all paint their own faces as well. They all put on their own masks. And it becomes, you might could say, the symbol of their old Adam coming out, as well as Jack's symbol of authority, his symbol of power.
Yeah, and what supports the argument that Jack is about chaos and disorder is the example of the painting, the first time he paints his face. I don't know if this struck you, because it struck me quite profoundly that the first time he paints the face, his the two sides of his face are painted symmetrically. But then he washes it off. It's not savage enough. It's not disordered enough for him. So I don't remember exactly how it works, but he's got one side with white around his eye, and the other side is, they're painted two different colors, and there's a slash of charcoal across one side. And it's such a disfigurement of his face, you know, which obviously represents then the disfigurement of him internally.
Yeah, he says here, here's the text. He says, Jack planned his new face. He made one cheek and one eye socket white. Then he rubbed red over the other half of his face and slashed a black bar of charcoal across from right ear to left jaw. He looked in the pool for his reflection, but his breathing troubled the mirror.
Yeah, he couldn't even see his own reflection because of how disordered it was, that the mirror didn't even behave.
That was on page 82 to 83. In fact, Golding also continues in the next paragraph. He talks about how delighted he is about this mask. And he says he began to dance and his laughter became a bloodthirsting snarling. He capered toward Bill and the mask was a thing on its own, behind which Jack hid, liberated from shame and self-consciousness, right? So it became the mask behind which he hid in order to become the savage beast that he becomes later on in the book. Yeah. The other figure that we need to talk about, though he wasn't a major figure, was Simon. And Simon is the young boy that Jack's tribe, in reenacting one of their pig hunts, they kill him as the one that they think is the beast. And he eventually washes out to sea. He is, you might say, the messenger of the Lord of the Flies. And if you look on page 199 of your book, you can see Simon actually having a conversation with the Lord of the Flies. Now, what's really ironic about this is when you realize who the Lord of the Flies is. the Lord of the Flies is... Well, actually, do you know anything about the Lord of the Flies? Apart from this book? Apart from this book, Chris?
Actually, no. There's more to be known.
Yeah, there's more to this. Yeah,
it's like a pagan myth or something.
Well, no, it's the translation of Beelzebub.
Oh, I suppose I did know that at one point. Yeah, yeah. I remember that from. See, I've read this book before. Unlike Mr. Eskins here.
Yeah, this is my first reading. Yeah,
I read this in sophomore year of high school. It was required reading, but this set me on that course, and I followed with this theme ever since. That the inner dialogue that people have, which is really one of the themes, and do you listen to that dialogue, or do you not? Do you follow what you know is to be true and right, or do you follow that which you know is wrong, but is of the more base instinct of your flesh? Which is the theme going on here, which Lord of the Flies, it's Beelzebub, fine. But he's internal to even Simon, even this most pious and actually, you know, very reverent. I mean, he goes to this sanctuary in the middle of the forest where only the butterflies flutter and the sun, you know, cuts through. And it's very nice. It's a very calm and quiet place for him, apart from all of these, you know, the machinations of democracy or the chaos of the savage people under the dictator. And he goes to this pious place, and then it is defiled.
Or maybe that's the point, that even in some sense, society, whether savage tribe or democracy, is to be preferred to self-exclusion. I don't know. I mean, maybe it is the fact that he's on his own, because none of the other boys ever go out to their own and do their own thing. Nobody but Simon does.
And the reality is that it was that it was there the whole time.
Right.
That he was running from something that was internal to him.
Yeah. In fact, if you look on page 200 to 201 in your book, when Simon is talking to the Lord of the Flies, it reads, Simon shook, and the Lord of the Flies says, "There isn't anyone to help you, only me, and I'm the beast." Simon's mouth labored, brought forth audible words, "Pig's head on a stick." Fancying thinking the beast was something you could hunt and kill, said the head. For a moment or two, the forest and all the other dimly appreciated places echoed with a parody of laughter. "You knew, didn't you? I'm part of you. Close, close, close. I'm the reason why it's no go. Why things are what they are." You're exactly right. That the beast is internal. The Lord of the Flies is part of who he is. And this is, in the end, what is symbolic of Ralph destroying the Lord of the Flies, right? Because before they're rescued, Ralph actually destroys the skull. That's on page, I have that too. That's on page 262. Page 262. Ralph actually destroys the skull. It falls apart, and he uses the stick that was the head upon which the Lord of the Flies sat. Do we ever describe what the Lord of the Flies is? I don't think we did. Lord of the Flies was actually the first pig that, maybe it was the second pig that Jack killed. They cut the head off and put it on a stake, and stuck it in the middle of this meadow. And,
it's the first pig killed. Through group effort, right?
Because he kills the first one by himself.
Correct.
Right. And so it's the first pig killed through group effort, and they leave this head on a stick as a payment to the beast, this beast that they're afraid of and that's supposedly hunting them throughout the entire book. They leave this pig's head as an homage to the beast. But here you see in page 2 or page 199-200 that the Lord of Flies is actually saying he is internal. He is part of each of these boys.
Right, and you know the one thing that I have that I struggled with is the beast from the sky, as the chapter is called. You know, mm-hmm. when the parachute man lands on the top of the mountain and eventually is consumed by the flies.
I didn't realize he was consumed by the flies.
Right, his body is rotted, but the only reason why he's maintained his form is because of the uniform that he wears. Right. Mm-hmm. And that the parachute is what causes him to rise up and to fall, and until eventually he is with the storm, the same storm when Simon is killed, incidentally.
Right.
During that storm with the lightning, that's when the beast departs, because now the real beast has become evident,
right?
Or has taken root, if you like, or found its home in Jack and all of his cohorts. So we no longer require the man on the top of the mountain anymore.
Right. That's why Simon is considered the messenger of the Lord of the Flies, even though he's probably, of all of them, the most innocent, if you can say. He's the one that goes into, goes out from the Lord of the Flies as the Lord of the Flies messenger to the boys, and then the boys identify him as the beast and kill him. And that's when he dies and washes out to sea. He's not actually killed by the boys until after he's spoken to the Lord of the Flies.
Which is, of course, a classic concept that the messenger would be identified with the the sender.
Yeah.
How would you say that properly? The messenger is identified with his master.
In the intro, I wanted to note that E.M. Forster, while he affirms that Golding had some kind of concept of original sin, a Christian concept of original sin, he doesn't in the book have a Christian concept of God. He writes, E.M. Forster writes in the intro, "When a deity does appear, he is the Lord of the Flies, Beelzebub, and he sends a messenger to prepare his way before him." So there is in no sense, at least I don't see one either, I agree with Forster, that I don't see in any way a Christian concept of God, which kind of then leads into some of our summary thoughts. Is that a problem? Must there be some sort of Christological theme or some theological underpinning in order for us to be able to read and appreciate this book as a piece of literature, as Christians reading a piece of literature?
Well, there is an element. The reason why I'm fascinated with this style of literature, and even when it's played out in a film, for example, a darker film about the more base nature of man, is that it demonstrates to us the depravity of man, really. And I think, I mean, Golding presents a view of humanity that is pretty much without hope. of themselves. I mean, it's only through the most ironic of circumstances where, you know, where Piggy is killed and Ralph is being hunted finally, that he received, the smoke is sent forth in such a way that he's discovered. And it almost is accidental. It's ironic, certainly, but it's accidental. Not to Golding, of course, but or to the book, but just to the way things happen. Mm-hmm. You know, then on a different occasion, Ralph would have been found, and the boys would have finally degraded into absolute anarchy. Mm-hmm. And which would be the natural conclusion. Eventually, someone would have risen against Jack and would have destroyed even this community.
Right.
While they have chosen him by giving in to this nature, they cannot live with any order, even a dictatorship order.
Maybe you kind of see that in Roger. I mean, is that the point of Roger, that even Roger could have been the one that would eventually undermine the authority of Jack?
Correct. Because he saw that he was tempted by the shell, you know, to claim the shell, and instead he followed Jack and then chose that path.
And ultimately, he's the one that destroys the shell, too, because he's the one that dislodges the rock, kills Piggy, and crushes the shell. So Jack, in that sense, doesn't even crush the shell. That's Roger. My question was, I at least don't see any sort of Christological themes in the book. I mean, of course...
I disagree. Piggy,
well, but see, I noticed that. But see, I don't think Piggy is a Christological figure. He doesn't die for anyone. I mean, his death doesn't save Ralph in any way. His death doesn't save anybody.
No, I left... That was actually as a question. I don't believe Piggy is the strongest Christological character in this book.
Well, then who would you say?
It has to be Simon. Simon, the one who recognizes, you know, the evil within him, but who resists and goes to warn the people and is killed for it. And I think the evidence that if anyone is Christological, this is the guy, is the manner into which he's assumed into the sea. It kind of rides there. Yeah, 2:15. So toward midnight, the rain ceased and the clouds drifted away, so the sky was scattered once more in the incredible lamps of stars. Then the breeze died too. There was no noise save the drip and trickle of water that ran out of clefts and spilled down leaf by leaf to the brown earth of the island. The air was cool, moist, and clear. And presently even the sound of the water was still. The beast lay huddled on the pale beach and the stain spread inch by inch. The edge of the lagoon became a streak of phosphorescence which advanced minutely as the great wave of the tide flowed. The clear water mirrored the clear sky and the angular bright constellations. The light of phosphorescence bulged about the sand grains and little pebbles. It held them, each in a dimple of tension, then suddenly accepted them with an inaudible syllable and moved on. I don't know, it keeps going. Here we go.
This is the good stuff, beginning with a long.
Right, so we can just edit that part out. Along the shoreward edge of the shallows, the advancing clearness was full of strange, moonbeam-bodied creatures with fiery eyes. Here and there a larger pebble clung to its own air and was covered with a coat of pearls. The tide swelled in over the rain-pitted sand and smoothed everything with a layer of silver. Now it touched the first of the stains that seeped from the broken body, and the creatures made a moving patch of light as they gathered at the edge. The water rose farther and dressed Simon's coarse hair with brightness. The line of his cheeks silvered and the turn of his shoulder became sculptured marble. The strange attendant creatures with their fiery eyes and trailing vapors busied themselves round his head. The body lifted a fraction of an inch from the sand and a bubble of air escaped from the mouth with a wet plop. Then it turned gently in water. Somewhere over the darkened curve of the world, the sun and moon were pulling, and the film of water on the Earth planet was held, bulging slightly on one side while the solid core turned.
I don't understand the inquisitive bright creatures or their fiery eyes and trailing vapors. What is he talking about there?
See, this is why there may not be a deity in the book, but it is here made evident. I mean, this is the assumption of the sacrifice. This is the receiving. I mean, even the transformation of the dead into the brightness, you know, of the hair, which is indicative, of course, of wisdom. The line of his cheeks silvered, and the turn of his shoulder became sculptured marble. This is a revelation vision. This is like John's apocalypse. What happens to the Son of God, the Son of Man.
But at the same time, can it be Christological in the sense he doesn't? There's no sacrifice for anyone else, though, is there? I mean, he is a sacrifice. That he was, you might say, that he was the messenger of the beast, right? He was identified with the message and killed as such. But is it, in what way does his death rescue the boys, or in what way does his death free them from their barbarism or their?
It certainly rests Ralph and Piggy, and probably among some of the other Litlands, you know, as they approach that feast. And they're receiving the feast reluctantly. They acknowledge that they joined in, and they said these words: "Killed the beast, cut his throat, spill his blood." It's just, you can't help but hear the crucifixion in this. Do him in, even at the end. And they, you know, after the death, they recognize that they participated. You know, that it was murder, and that they were on the outside, but they were there, and they were party to it. And it is Simon's death that redeems them from following that path. It's his witness, his example. They even heard his words as he approached. I don't remember exactly which words they remembered.
Right.
But they remembered that he was warning them. And so, I mean, is it a full picture of Christ? I don't think so. I mean, his blood doesn't atone for them. No.
Right.
But that, if there is a Christian theme, that's the one in my book. Hopefully I provide enough evidence to bear that out.
Well, you might have been enough to convince me. I wasn't convinced that there was a Christological theme.
Right.
But you might be enough to convince me there that there... I mean, there's... Well, and maybe that's another question. I mean, and maybe this is for another edition, I don't know. But is it possible to even be without a Christological figure, or is the necessary pattern of a story such that there will always be some form of Christological figure, whether or not you baptize it? You know, is there always some form of a Christological sacrifice that makes a good story a good story? Maybe that's what Tolkien was getting at with the Yew catastrophe, the end of the story that ends well, this catastrophe that actually brings about the glorious ending of the story, that without this catastrophe there can't be redemption, and through this catastrophe there comes redemption. I mean, is that a necessary ingredient of a true story, and therefore also will necessarily have some form of Christological theme? I don't know. Good question.
It is a good question. I think it would be interesting to discuss the fate of those on the island a little bit more. Specifically the boys that follow Jack. I don't recall that their rescue is described.
Oh, no, they're in there. Yeah, they're in there. Or they are rescued.
Is that a true rescue? I mean, they've already been transformed into something other. What the island is it is the hell of their own making, right? It's exactly what their flesh desires. It's exactly what they want. But they're so short-term in their thinking. They're not thinking of eventual rescue, redemption. The rescue, I mean, this is the salvation comes by those outside the island. If they're left to the island, the natural end, I said, was chaos, and that I believe that Jack would probably be overthrown in the end, and it would they would end up murdering each other more than likely. But the other thing that's interesting is in the death of when they discover the sow, right before the death of Simon. I mean, that's the sow is the one they discover. They care nothing for the longevity of their future on that island. By murdering the sow, they're destroying their future posterity. Because now those piglets have no mother.
Right. so now there's no more food, no more meat.
Exactly. Yeah. Their thought is so temporary and fleeting, and without just thought of the future. It's all for the moment, which is, of course, you know, the lie that was in the garden, of course, from Beelzebub himself. You know, that if you eat of this, you will surely not die. Well, not yet, but you will. Right. And the death will be far worse than what you can possibly imagine now. And, yeah. And ultimately the fate of everyone on that island will be the same as the man who I think we're to presume is the enemy, you know, of whatever war is happening. It's kind of a timeless story. It doesn't really matter. Although we're identify with England in the Navy, so I suppose that does set its context, but I'm being written in 54, correct? Sets its context a little bit. But at the same time, you know, their fate is going to be just like that man. It may be like Piggy's, you know, it may be like Simon's even. Mm-hmm. And they're not concerned of rescue from that, you know, never mind starvation. You know, it's an interesting... coping with the reality of death is not even on their map. It's not even part of their thought process. Which of course is what the Lord of the Flies is aiming for, is all of their death in the end.
Right. Well, and all their death in the seeking of, is how I should say it, in the seeking of love, or seeking of fun. In the seeking of fun is how he actually wants them all to die. Because he even says that when he was talking to Simon, he talks about how this is all about having fun, right? You're having lots of fun, right? And so the whole idea behind The Lord of the Flies is to bring about the death, like you said, of the entire crew. The most helpful aspect of the book being his expression of original sin and the natural man, that all that culture naturally, apart from the active work of men, the active work ultimately of God through men as his masks, will devolve into this anarchy of the little boys. In this sense, the little boys aren't so much little boys, but they kind of stand in for the greater theme there of all men, of all humankind, to be right. Politically correct.
Right, and from a very Lutheran perspective, that the order of society, the government of society, whatever order that is God given and God preserved and maintained for the purpose of them. And so the fact that and you also have the aspect of the law then with the fourth commandment and these children honoring, you know, their authorities and their parents in mimicking their form of government, mm-hmm. knowing that this is for their preservation of their life. That they may live long on the earth, right? Mm-hmm. And when they devolve from that, from the order of a family, of household, the order of good government, that's when they collapse. I don't believe that Golding really is interested in which form of government is better. They're more concerned about whether these children are following the desires of their heart or the good of humanity.
Forster sees, he says you can read it on a simple level as just the... like on a basic level, is just the interplay between democracy and dictatorship, between democracy and ordered chaos, you might say.
Well, you would expect
that's kind of an oxymoron, but
it's a Cold War. It's a Cold War book. I mean, it's written in the era of the Cold War, so it's probably going through his mind. But I think it can be bigger than that. It can transcend even the author's intent.
Yeah, and that was going to be my next question. You know, you were talking about Simon and Simon's sacrifice. And do you think that, and I don't necessarily think so, but do you think Golding intended to make that a Christological figure? In other words, can you have a character in a story such as Simon that the author does not intend? You know, once again, we're not trying to get at the author's intent of the story. We're trying to take the story as it is. But at the same time, can you have a character in a story that's Christological, yet not intended to be Christological by the author? And I think so. I happen to agree.
I mean, try to get yourself in the head of Golding. I don't know what he was thinking at that moment, because it's such a dramatic switching of gear. It is the only moment in the entire book of true transcendent beauty that happens. The rest of there's so many opportunities when they're at the lagoon. You know, there's opportunities to talk about, you know, how wonderful mm-hmm. this island is and all of the glorious aspects. And he does talk about the pink rocks and the scales, but this is the only time where it's just glorious and right. beautiful and really magnificent. And, you know, was he just having a good day when he got to that point? I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that was very intentional. See, that's why I don't know. I mean, I haven't read anybody's criticism of this. I have no idea what I read or what I thought back when I read it in high school. But, you know, you would be tempted to think that the climax of the story is at or immediately before that, the final showdown between Jack and Ralph, right. Which ends up not being successful for Ralph, actually, I mean, apart from the rescue. But it comes too late in the book. That's why I made the argument that he's cruising from that act. That's where finally those who are good, which is, by the way, the few, and the many pursue evil.
Right.
That's the moment where those lines are drawn, and right. it becomes the act that defines. You know, who the Lord of the Rings is, where he comes from, and what it's all about.
No, that's a good point, because you look at the rest of the book, and any picture of, or often the pictures of the island are not pictures of, like you said, of beauty, but rather pictures of how the boys have ruined the island by the fire that burned the one side of the island, by the fire that burned the other side of the island. He actually starts off the book talking about the scar. I was so confused, actually, when I started the book. It was really jarring, because he's talking about this scar, and he never actually talks about what created the scar, but eventually you figure out that the cabin of the ship as it crashed in the jungle created a scar, and that scar became one of the points around which the community was organized.
Correct.
And so even there, the essential beauty of the island is marred by something that...
Right. Immediately we learn the island is dangerous too, because mm-hmm. the boys are, it's not thorns, but the creepers, mm-hmm. you know, are tearing at them. I mean, they're damaging these boys as they're crawling along, and so they're being hurt immediately, you know, by the island,
right?
And so we sense that, I mean, there's a great deal of danger here already from the get-go. That they're, you know, whatever their context is. What's remarkable is the conversation between Ralph and Jack about what ends up being Jack's fortress, his castle. And the quality of life that this castle will provide, it's a dangerous place. It's a rocky place. It doesn't have food. It was salt water. It didn't have pure water, apart from a little trickle where they'd have to put, you know, a coconut shell to collect it. That it's not a good place to be. It's a bad place to be. And yet Jack, you know, he's already connected to that place when they discover it. He's drawn to it. He knows that this is the kind of place where he actually needs to be.
Oh, sure. So, is this a book you'd... Well, let's do it this way. How would you talk about this book with your children? What kind of age range would you suggest for this book? And how would you talk about this book with a kid in that age range? And I was thinking, I mean, high school, more than likely. I mean, you wouldn't want somebody 7th and 8th grade reading this, would you?
I would have.
Really?
But what I was going to suggest is this is one of those times, which you're going to hear a lot about on this show, where you want to think of it not in terms of age range, but in terms of educational maturity. And mm-hmm. I would say this is appropriate for someone who has learned both the grammar of their faith, and they have also learned the logic of their faith, you know, how it works in a doctrinal way. So they know of original sin. They know how to confess original sin, not just, you know, simple, you know, the faith of the scriptures, but how it's confessed in our confession and the doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the classical education form of educating your children, where it begins with the grammar stage, moves us to a logic stage, and then finally moves to rhetoric. Correct.
Correct. So I would suggest that this would be appropriate for someone, at least theologically and probably practically speaking too, in the rhetoric stage, where they're ready to dialogue with other traditions or other, frankly, scary things. This actually, I mean, from that perspective, it very much could be a helpful apologetic tool if it's part of a dialogue with maybe middle school, but likely high school age children who are encountering people who have such a view of humanity or of the world as Golding presents, which is true apart from Christ.
Yeah, yeah, and that sense in talking about it with other people, perhaps even if you're a parent listening to this, talking about it with your children, the idea here is to help your children realize that not only is murder wrong and as a basic violation of the Fifth Commandment, but to help them realize that this violation of the Fifth Commandment is something that belongs with each and every person, regardless of who you are, that each person violates the Fifth Commandment, each person murders or hates, and that this isn't just something that belongs to a few people, but rather, as we see, as all the boys gather around and kill Simon, all the boys, even Ralph and Piggy, the ones who are the signs of order and democracy in the community, even they are guilty of committing the same sin. And so that even within our own hearts, we find this murder, and that it's necessary to have this sin, as Kenneth Corby says, owned, that to own your sin, and then to have it to absolve by the Lord.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And you really see this play out in that Ralph resents Jack from the get-go. I mean, actually,
was it the other way around? Was it the other way? It was the other way around, didn't Jack?
Well, I think it's unilateral. I don't think it's unilateral. It's
bilateral.
It's bilateral, and that there's a mutual disdain. I think as it develops, it certainly becomes anger and hatred towards each other, and right. the opportunity to at least delay and maybe even prevent Jack's demise is to treat him with care and concern. To recognize his talents, his abilities, his gifts, maybe even his calling, you know, having a choir behind him, which Ralph does to some degree, but doesn't defer to him in a way that perhaps would have prevented. Certainly, it's the anger of Ralph that inspires Jack's hatred of him.
right on the mountain when Jack lets the fire go out, right. And
just forgive him. Just forgive him, and say, "Isn't it wonderful? You got a pig for us. Now that we can eat something other than this diarrhea-inducing fruit." it puts Jack's anger. It would put that anger, even maybe hatred of Ralph, to shame.
Right. Right. Rather than making it, and this is the natural inclination of each of us, Ralph turns it into a power play. His goal is to try and use this this occurrence where the fire goes out, and because Jack is off pig hunting, Ralph tries to use this as an opportunity to gain authority, more authority amongst the rest of the hunter boys. And Goldig even says he does to some small degree, but this ultimately becomes, like you said, the reason that Jack's hatred for Ralph is so strong and leads to his forming of his own tribe.
And the murders.
And the murders.
Of Simon and Piggy. Correct. But it is an exposition on the Fifth Commandment. There's no way around that.
No, you're right, it is, but an exposition on the Fifth Commandment, not in the sense of blaming other people and pointing out other people's sins, but recognizing your own sin. That's the point, right? Recognizing that it's not just other people that are out there murdering, but you yourself are one of the murderers.
And again, Simon is the only one who makes the confession. Who Ralph and Piggy, even recognizing because of their shame, they don't confess it.
Right. They actually deny being there at the dance where Simon is killed, at the feast where Simon is killed. He spends a lot of time talking about how they deny actually being present.
Correct. Which in the end is not absolution.
That's once again where Kenneth Corby from Issues Etc., the late Kenneth Corby, says, own the sin. It's your sin. You can't blame it on somebody else. You can't say, I just happened to be there, or, you know, the other boys made me do it. Own the sin. It's your sin. You murdered. You hate. Now you go confess.
Yeah. You crucified your Lord.
Right. Exactly. Now shut up and receive absolution.
Right.
Exactly. Acknowledge your sin, receive absolution. So,
right.
We will be doing Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins next time. Hardcover edition you can find at Amazon. The link is in the show notes.
All right. Thanks for joining us. All right. Till next time.
until next time.
This is Lies Speaking Truth. Thank you for listening.